Thank you, Paul. Good to be with you all today. I feel uplifted by having been here so far. From the end of November to the beginning of the new year, it's considered a feasting time in our country. And yet, when we come to the new year, there's a time of resolution for possibly doing things a bit differently than we've done them in the past. So I thought this might be a good morning to talk to you about an issue that grates against the American spirit to some extent, and yet it's a very biblical subject. There are at least 123 references in the Bible to fasting. Fasting is not something we talk about very often, at least I don't. Refusing to eat for a religious reason, even if we miss only one meal to accomplish something for God, would be considered fasting. In the Bible, there are three different forms of it. One is an absolute fast, where we neither eat food nor drink water. That's what Moses did for 40 days, which seems to me to be a supernatural thing. You can't ordinarily go 40 days without water. But Moses did, apparently with the help of God, because under other conditions, one would completely dehydrate in 3 to 4 days. But there is the absolute fast. There's also what's considered the normal fast in the Bible. That's where you take no food, but you do drink water. And then third, sometimes in the Bible, we have a partial fast. Daniel and his friends would be an example of this. They ate pulse, whatever that is, probably something like a vegetable soup, perhaps, pulse and water. And the fact that that may have been a superior diet to what was on the king's table does not take away from the fact that it was indeed a fast. Fasting is abstaining from food for a religious reason. And the usual amount of time for a fast in the Bible is one day. Elijah, down by the brook, was fed by ravens. That would be a partial fast. He ate flesh on that occasion that God had the birds take to him. God doesn't seem like he's a vegetarian. We're told in the book of Proverbs 17, verse 1, better is a dry morsel and quietness therewith than a house full of sacrifices with strife. It seems biblically that food should take a relatively minor place in our lives because there are so many other things that are more important, including domestic peace, as he said there in Proverbs. There was just one fast that was commanded of ancient Israel from the very beginning, and that was the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur. On that day, they were told to afflict their souls, which was a euphemism for not eating. Afflicting your soul would be the natural response that people would have to the lack of food. They feel uncomfortable. They feel, to a certain degree, afflicted. And fasting is intended to make us somewhat uncomfortable. It's a voluntary subjecting of the body to the needs of the spirit. As I said, this is difficult in America. It kind of grates against the American spirit because we're living in a melting pot of people from around the world. And the melting pot has become a dinner pot. Every nationality that has immigrated to our shores has contributed its native culinary skills and its tastiest dishes to our diet today. You don't have to drive very far from where we are right now to find Italian food, Chinese food, Mexican food. We've developed all kinds of new varieties of plants and animals to eat, yielding quantities of food at doubled and redoubled production rates. Just look at the turkeys we have now. We have complete frozen dinners that can be stored until we need them. They can be heated almost instantaneously in a microwave. Leftovers can be preserved conveniently in refrigeration. Transportation and storage makes foods that were once regarded as seasonal available now throughout the year. We have a greater variety of food by far than was available to King Solomon in his heyday, and it's available to all of us as Americans. We're still so far below our agricultural potential that we can't even imagine what an actual famine would be like. We eat in part because the food is always there to be eaten. There's always a McDonald's on the next corner, and if we feel a little twinge of hunger, there it is right in front of us. Our eating habits were inherited from a time when food was in short supply, and the ordinary meal was little more than a temporary escape from an almost constant hunger, and a time when a feast was a rare event. The eating process was purposefully arranged in order to allow maximum consumption with minimum discomfort, because when you had a feast, it might be your last meal for a long time. It was uncertain when your next meal would be. So you started with foods that encouraged the appetite without filling you up, like salads, and then you went on to dishes that constituted the main substance of the meal, meats and so forth. And then last, you had sweets, which would sustain your desire to eat and your ability to eat for as long as possible. Keep on eating those cakes and pies. I think that's the way it was put together in the way that it was. But in the Bible, food is seen as a means to an end, not as an end in itself. In the Bible, the focus of your life was not on consumption, but on your work. How could you best get your work done? Food supplies the necessary strength to do the work. And the Bible says that it's only if you do work that you're even entitled to eat. So in the Bible, we never live in order to eat, but we eat in order to live, and this is done to the glory of God. We all admire craftsmen who are able to use skills use tools in a skillful manner. We admire an artist with a brush when they do a good job, or a musician with an instrument, or a carpenter with a plane. We need to have the same kind of interest in the use and misuse of our bodies, because no finer instrument exists than the human body. And any instrument that's utilized for self-destruction is an instrument that's being disused. The bodies that God gave us are to be used to honor Him, and this principle is so fundamental that it even overrides the principle of self-preservation at times. If the destruction of my body could somehow accomplish the will of Christ in a given situation, like, say, falling on a hand grenade to save a bunch of other people, that would be the destruction of my body, but it would save other people, then in those kind of cases, we surrender the body to destruction. Our bodies that God gave us are part of a larger reality, and to fail to recognize that this is something that God has ordained for us is a fundamental error about the nature of this human instrument. A similar mistake would be to use the telephone on my desk just as a paperweight. It would make a good paperweight, but there are things that telephone could do that are far beyond just being a paperweight. So using my body in a way that does not live up to the glory of God in every way that I can is similar to that. That my telephone has an invisible connection to all the other phones in the world, and that would be completely overlooked if I used my phone just as a paperweight. So the human body has to be understood as just one aspect of the total personality of a human being. The body is of only secondary importance. Jesus taught us that we need not fear those who have the power to kill us physically, because there's something more important than that. So when we talk about fasting, we have to recognize the purpose of it. If you refrain from eating just in order to lose weight, that might be good. But if you do it for that reason alone, that's not fasting in the sense of which I'm speaking of it this morning. If you stop smoking just to avoid cancer and for that reason alone, that's good, but it's not to the highest of what we can talk about this morning. If you exercise just in order to live longer, and for that reason alone, your gains are only physical in nature. But if your purpose is to express the will of God in every aspect of your being, if your discipline regarding eating and drinking and exercise is directed to this end, then you bring yourself into the focus of what your life is really about. You put it into a godly perspective. Rather than contradicting your basic nature, you're working in harmony with your nature as God has created it. And your task of controlling yourself becomes simpler. That doesn't mean it becomes easy, but it becomes simpler. Fasting will probably have about the effect on your physical body that you think it will. If we educated ourselves on the value of a day without food, we might find not so much weakness as we do actual strength. There is a natural purifying process and a healing process in the act of fasting. and the rest that's given to the organs of the body seems to be good for them. Hunger is a habit. We tend to get hungry at the times that we are used to getting hungry. There is no danger to the average healthy person in a day or two or three without food. The body can live off our excess fat for longer than we might imagine. And when that hunger habit asserts itself, we can just remind ourselves what it is. That's just a habitual response. I don't need to be unduly concerned about it. What we're talking about here is a kind of a spiritual surgery. And that's difficult because each of us operates on himself. Nobody else can do it for us. Spiritual anesthetics are unknown. So there is pain involved. Every patient has to withstand that pain. The knowledge of spiritual anatomy is so rudimentary that we really don't know very much about this. Every operation on ourselves must be carried out as though it were being done for the first time. All the spiritual operations that are insisted on for us in the Bible are primarily amputations, cutting something off from our lives. Many times they are drastic. They are radical. Cutting off the hand or poking out your eye was the way the Lord put it in the 5th chapter of the book of Matthew. But the spiritual surgeon only needs to be concerning himself with one disease. In the physical life, as we've said this morning, there are diseases we don't understand and that we don't even have names for all of them yet. There's so many varieties of that. But there's just one real disease that we're fighting against on a spiritual basis, and that basic disease is sin. That's what we're trying to eradicate from our lives. Many diverse forms assumed by our own self-love and our own self-worship. Idols, whatever they may be, are really projections of ourselves, in which we're worshiping ourselves rather than the one true and living God. Think about the statement that was made in 1 Kings 13 with the old prophet and the young prophet. The young prophet went up to do a job and he wasn't supposed to eat till he got back home. But there was an old prophet that said, well, I've had a latter-day revelation that has changed. And God told me it was okay for you to come to my house and eat. Evidently, fasting was associated in some way with the message of condemnation that young prophet had. And he went and delivered that message. Fasting was a vital part of his mission. He was just as important as the message was, just as important as the miracle that young prophet performed at Bethel. And yet, he allowed this old prophet to change his mind on this. And there's always going to be old prophets around who will tell you that fasting is not a part of God's plan for your life today. But as we look at the Bible, I don't see where this was ever abrogated. Any fast before God should not be entered into lightly, because it's done before God. It's not that God will send a lion to kill you if you break your fast at the wrong time like he did with that young prophet. But there is a roaring lion going about seeking whom he may devour. So we need to be careful when we enter into a fast to fulfill what we have purposed to do. All kinds of people in the world have been moved to fast at various times. And what I'm saying to you is that if Mahatma Gandhi thought enough of his cause and his gods to fast because such a condition would enable him to concentrate better, if Hindu priests and African witch doctors and American Indians fast in order to enhance the work of their false gods, if the pagan soldiers back in the Old Testament associated fasting with obtaining mercy from God as they understood him, could fasting help us? Now, fasting can have bad purposes. Ahab, for example, would not eat bread in the case of Naboth's vineyard. That shows how totally selfish fasting can be. It can be both good and bad. The lust of the eye in the case of Ahab was so strong that he lost his appetite. He just had to have that vineyard. If we were as rich and powerful as King Ahab, there would always be that one more possession that we didn't have that we just can't live without, and we'd just be sick until we had it, as long as we had that mindset. Like one of the Rockefellers was asked, how much money is enough? And he said, just a little more, just a little more. So proclaim a fast and set Naboth up. and frame him so we can get rid of him so I can have that vineyard. Proclaim a fast. A fast was a part of the preparation for that. But there are also many good usages of it. Fasting clears the faculties. Fasting sharpens our attention. All God's gifts can be and have been prostituted. This should not minimize their proper use, however. Fasting is not necessary to show repentance or to prompt repentance, but it can be a catalyst for repentance. Fasting is a choice, not a command in our time. So in the passage that Denny read to us a while ago, when you fast, he doesn't tell you when to fast, but he just assumes that there will be occasions when you do this. When you fast, here are instructions for how to carry it out. But he never seems to assume that there would never be a time when his people would fast as individuals or perhaps otherwise. It can be a catalyst to good things. When fasting just becomes a meaningless ritual, then of course it loses its whole purpose. Now, it's very common to hear, well, if I don't get a good meal, I get weak, so I need something to keep up my strength so I can do my work well. And I understand that point of view, but to a certain extent, it reminds me of the story of Jacob and Esau, when Esau had been without food for a while. I think Esau tended to regard his body in much the same way that Americans do. He was an active sportsman-type character. He was an athlete. And if we had been the parents of those twins, Jacob and Esau, we might have worried about Jacob, the quiet one, rather than worrying about Esau. But Esau despised his birthright. He lost his sense of proportion. His physical cravings became the center of his world for the moment, and they defined the limits of his vision. Food became his sole purpose for living, because he said, I'm going to die anyway. Now, I don't believe that was true. I don't think he was going to die anyway, but he was just so hungry, he convinced himself that he was. And when we have a higher regard for our stomachs than for our minds and our spirits, we may find it easy to despise our birthright. Fasting should not cause us to emphasize our hunger for food, but rather to emphasize the spiritual feast that becomes possible for us when we learn to direct our thoughts away from the physical and center them on divine realities. The motivations of the heart are what lead us to fast. If our fast is no way related to our real spiritual needs, then it seems to me to be meaningless. Jesus fasted for 40 days. Chronologically, these were days that were wintry and cold. They didn't have a winter like we do, but they had a winter of their own, which always wasn't pleasant, rainy, and so forth. The temptation of Jesus contained the temptation of hunger, 40 days of fasting. Now, it was not a sin to be hungry, and it was not a sin to transform rocks into bread, in the sense that rock is broken down by soil and by sun and ice and wind and rain. Wheat is planted in that soil that used to be rocks, and grain is grown and ground into flour. So what used to be rocks become bread over the natural course of event. It wasn't sinful for Jesus to hunger. It wasn't sinful for him to act to satisfy the need of the hunger. The sin would have been for him to direct his divine power for that purpose. Because if he was going to identify himself with our condition, making himself subject to the limitations of time and space, he had to become the perfect sacrifice, and he had to share our lot so we could share his life. He would have only been pretending to share our lot if he could just automatically escape from hunger and pain and sorrow through artificial, miraculous means. And so he turned away from that easy solution, which the devil held up in front of him, because it would have been a misuse of his power. We bring our bodies under control that our minds might be devoted to the food that feeds the spirit. Are we ever so intent on discovering God's will that we just forget to eat? That can happen, and when you do have that happen, it's kind of an amazing thing. Take the example of Esther and Mordecai. Fasting there was an indication of the sincerity behind their request to God for help. Fasting and prayer does seem to make a difference with God. Fasting and prayer is obviously no substitute for individual initiative. Esther used her good sense, perhaps sharpened through fasting, to arrange favorable circumstances for the right response to her request. In the case of Mordecai, her relative, the best of fast can be, and sometimes are, misunderstood. We're so involved with the lives of other people that what we do or don't do often becomes known. If you live with other people, it's hard for them to not know sometimes if you're fasting, even if you're trying to keep the Lord's imperative to do it in secret. If you live with somebody and they know you skipped a meal, they know you skipped a meal. But even so, there's a place for this. David fasted over the misfortunes of his enemies. And that was seen on the part of his enemies as a sign of weakness in David, not a sign of strength in David. That should not excuse us from failing to fast. I do not believe that those who are around us in our families or who live with us should be forced to bear the burden of our sacrifices. If you're fasting, that doesn't mean the people you're living with should have to fast. Our error sometimes, I think, is in putting the emphasis on the meal that's being missed, when that's not where it's intended to be. The right view keeps its focus on this special time of study or discipline or work, whatever it is, which has replaced the attention that you would normally give to preparing food and eating it. True fasting requires more than a reorientation of eating, of our eating habits. God is never content with just the external forms which become empty and meaningless. Fasting begins with the dedication of ourselves. And the second stage of fasting is an awareness of the needs of others. So we don't let fasting make us short-tempered, for example. We find a completion in our acts to alleviate pain and hunger and save a soul, even though we're hungry because we've been fasting. It's not an end in itself. God is not impressed by our lack of food. Obedience is not only better than sacrifice, it's also a necessary quality to fasting, or that the fasting has no meaning. The Bible speaks of people whose God is their belly, and that can happen. It can happen to us if we're not careful. Philippians 3:19. Man was made to worship God, and everybody has his gods. The aspect of our life which is distinctively human is that which involves our system of values. So whether you're a Christian or an atheist or a humanist or an existentialist, you're going to worship something or somebody. Worth-ship. What is it that has the most important value to you? Every person is going to assign some ultimate value to something, and that something is his small g god or his big g god. So we don't want to ever be numbered with those whose god is their belly. Life only brings meaning and satisfaction when our goals are set higher than that. It's in the cross of Christ that we find not only our highest objective, but we find the power given to us to reach that highest objective. So the cross of Jesus Christ stands as a reminder that darkness cannot ultimately extinguish light, that good cannot ultimately overcome evil, and that life is always going to conquer death as long as we stick with the Lord. Personally, I think that a partial fast probably requires more discipline than just a normal fast where you're only drinking water, because the hunger barrier is overcome after a certain time. You'll be hungry at first, then you just keep drinking that water and you've forgotten about being hungry and you're able to go on and pursue other things. But if the hunger pangs are only partially satisfied by a restricted diet, I think that's harder personally. The battle goes on as long as the fast lasts in a case like that. A normal fast that's longer than one day, I don't think should be recommended for people who are beginning to do this. Reaching physical and spiritual goals is very important. And if you try to go more than 24 hours, that's difficult for people who aren't used to it. Think of David at the threshing floor of Arana the Jebusite. He offered land, he offered sacrifice, and David refused these things. David understood that sacrifice involves a self-giving, a self-denial. And so he would not take for free that which he was going to regard as his personal sacrifice. He would deny himself. In the ninth chapter of Daniel, Daniel was fasting when he was given the prophecy about the Daniel timetable, telling the very year when Jesus would come as the Messiah. He was fasting and reading the book of Jeremiah, and that is the context in which he was given that. I think motives mean so much with God. Why are you fasting? Why would you choose a partial fast over a full-fledged fast? Is it because you're addicted to coffee and you don't want to have to deal with the dilemma of not having it? I don't know. This is a very personal thing, and we cannot answer for each other on this. We don't even know each other's personal habits where these things are concerned. But I do believe that if we're living in bondage to any habit, then it's harder for us to claim a real freedom in the Lord. And I said any habit, knowing that fasting itself could become a form of bondage and habit. So we're talking here primarily about the condition of the heart. Rend your hearts and not your garments, as it was put in the second chapter of Joel. Thanksgiving comes from a full heart, not from a full stomach. The people of Nineveh, when they believed the preaching of Jonah, they fasted, and they even had their animals fast. Through a kind of biotic rapport, they believed their animals were an extension of them. And they forced their animals to fast. I've spent enough time on the farm to know that if you don't feed the animals when they're used to being fed, they can put up a ruckus that you won't be able to ignore. The city of Nineveh must have been very loud for the duration of that fast. But they even caused their animals to fast. Denny read from Matthew chapter 6. And in particular, the last thing he read was verses 16 through 18. Many people, on the basis of this, have concluded that fasting was for the Jews only and not for the Gentiles. I've never understood that conclusion. It's true that Jewish tradition had set Monday and Thursday of every week as fast days, and the Pharisees were quite careful to keep those. They fasted twice in the week, as in Luke 18 we have the Pharisee saying in his prayer, when his prayer is contrasted with the prayer of the publican. I fast twice in the week. I don't know about you, but I fast twice in the week. That was the emphasis, it seems. And it was worse than meaningless because it became a point of pride. This is not something to be proud of. Fasting is a natural expression, and therefore it cannot be arbitrarily regulated. The frequency of your fast, the length of your fast, must be determined by your constitution, your needs, your activities, and your medication. Some people should not fast because their doctors have prescribed a drug to be taken at certain times with food. Well, I think if you're going to go to a doctor, you ought to be willing to do what the doctor says. So some people should not fast. But I just want us to think in terms of this because it's such an important biblical subject. Jesus said in the case of his meeting with the woman at the well, he told his disciples, "I have meat to eat that you know not of." They had gone away into the city to buy food. Jesus had that conversation with that woman. They get back and he says, "I have meat to eat that you know not of. My meat is to do the will of my Father and to finish his work." He was so interested in getting the work done that he wasn't thinking in terms of eating. It's interesting to me that when we come to the case of Gentile churches in Acts 13, 1 through 3, in Acts 14, 21 through 23, we're abbreviating this morning, so I'm not going to go into all that, but just to stress one point here. Fasting was a part of the apostolic church. The church at Antioch was a Gentile church. The first congregation in which the apostles were called Christians, Acts 11, 26. Fasting and prayer in chapter 13 and chapter 14 are clearly indicated as a practice of those early Christians when they got ready to set aside or publicly recognize their leaders. When they appointed officers, there was somebody who fasted. Now, how long that lasted or just who fasted, we're not told. There's no definite answers to that. But at Lystra, Derbe, Iconium, Antioch, these were predominantly Gentile churches, and there was fasting going on there. So it was not just for Jews. And Paul, when he brought this about, was acting under the direction of the Holy Spirit, not under the direction of his Jewish heritage. The responsibilities of the oversight of the flock were so important that a period of fasting and prayer seemed to be the natural response to the need. Jesus didn't give any evidence when he fasted that the lack of food represented any great sacrifice on his part. Contrary to that, his physical hunger seemed to leave him because he was finding opportunities to partake of spiritual food. So he didn't resemble the average man on a diet. We don't see any martyr complex. We don't see any evidence of shortness of temper. We don't see any overwhelming concern with his physical needs. He seemed to forget his natural desire for nourishment in his concern for his work. And I think this demonstrates a principle that we dare not ignore. Somebody who is spiritually starved may develop an excessive hunger for physical food in an attempt to compensate for his need. But let that man be satisfied spiritually, and some of the physical hunger may just disappear. The Lord partook of the strength which comes from obedience to the will of his Father. He found food and drink in the labor of carrying out that mission. So in your fasting, you may find that you need to orient yourself in a new way. In giving yourself, you may come to enjoy the real Christian feast. Your meat will be to do the will of him that sent you. I hope we can always find our true meat in following the example of Christ in this way, and to constantly remember that we do not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceedeth out of the mouth of God. We'll conclude at this time with the extension of the invitation. If anybody's here who wants to bring something before the congregation, we'd be happy to have you do that at this time. Let us know what your needs are as we stand together and sing the number that we're about to be led.